open to questions.
Yeah. So we've got 10, 15 minutes or so. Who would like to start? Yes.
I've just got a little question. I don't understand what you were saying that the industrialized countries have to bring the chaos or?
Chaos.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, all right. Under Kyoto, industrialized countries, so-called Annex I countries, entered into obligations to reduce their emissions measured at the baseline year of 1990 by a certain percentage. That these are chemicals. Quantified emission limitation, reduction objectives. So, very important term in the Kyoto lingo. But you're right, for asking, because once you're in this thing, you know, you chuckle around with these expressions and you talk to the outside world, people don't understand what you're talking about. That's the danger. You know, that's the danger I was referring to the scientists, that if you do something which has to be adopted and ratified later, and you do it in a way which is no longer understandable, you shoot yourself in the foot. Yes?
My concern is with the study of the difficult attempts, and also the right, the fact that they have a right to attend the content as representatives of
I'm sorry,
there will be mandates in advance who think they can take advantage of other people's clearances to jeopardize that safety. That's really what I'm concerned about.
You could be. If,
I saw what was possible at Bali.
Yeah.
I saw how it's prevented this time. I've seen someone coming with a lot more.
Yeah.
But I'm really not happy about it.
Sure. It's going to be.
I've seen the guy.
What is your question? How the security will be assured?
How do we prevent it? Because he'll pass on to another state.
Yeah. First of all, of course, you're right. A huge assembly of that nature always poses a certain security risk, or even a safety risk. Somebody might, you know, suffer from asthma or something. But a security risk, yes, in theory. But in actual fact, all the participants are issued with a badge and have to be announced before the conference. So that in order to walk into the room or into the conference facilities, you are screened to the utmost possible. That is not to say that, you know, something could not happen. But I would say the risk is rather small. I can't see any real major disruption of a thing that is organized by the Danes.
All right. Yeah.
Yes. Sure. No, from this end. No, that would be.
Thank you very much, Janet.
There seems to be a proposal being put forward that because it is not likely that we will reach a binding agreement at this meeting, that we should go into Copenhagen saying, let's not try for a binding agreement, let's just try for agreements that are not internationally enforceable instead. Do you think that would be a step forward or a step backwards?
It would be a step backwards. Unless we have a legally binding instrument in the end, we will not have a clear price indication for carbon. If we don't have a price indication for carbon, our carbon market will collapse. If our carbon market will collapse, we have no incentive whatsoever for any progress on the carbon field. That would be our most disaster. Janet, I agree with you that in Copenhagen, as such, this time around, as a first step, as the Danish Prime Minister has tried to set it, You know, one agreement, two steps. That's what he said. That's nice. Beautiful. You know, beautiful. Say an argument for itself. Because just imagine the Danes. It's the biggest chance they have for success. And it might slip the fingers. Yeah. And it might slip the fingers. So he tried to sell it. So if it's this time, that is probably what's going to happen. But if that was the overall agreement, the dismantlement of Kyoto, that would be a huge leap back. It's not just a second.
Could you just go a little bit further on this, Fiat, and say what you think might happen by way of an internationally binding agreement? Would it be simply a second commitment period under Kyoto, or would it in fact be a new protocol? And if it's a new protocol, what will happen to Kyoto?
Well, legally speaking, Kyoto will come to an end. Everything that comes after Kyoto needs to be ratified again by the parties. Nobody who's a member of Kyoto is automatically bound by the next step. Now, the decisive question is, will we get a second Kyoto along the line of Kyoto 1? And in addition to that, an add-on protocol to the convention, which will bind in one way or the other the countries that do not have Kelrose on a Kyoto 1. That is what the developing countries would like. They are willing to enter into a protocol ratifiable after the convention and ask for a Kyoto 2 with clear Kelrose. That's the problem. Now, the industrialized countries want to cherry pick important parts of Kyoto. We need that. We need the Kyoto mechanisms. It would be a sad story if the Kyoto mechanisms would go out of the window. It would be a sad story if we have to renegotiate the six gases. Or all, you know, the funds that there are there and the joint implementation board. All the nice things that were constructed. So we need to keep that, absolutely. But that needs to be put into a new instrument which needs to be ratified by every country. That's the problem. So it needs to be ratifiable by people in parliaments who have never been to a conference like that, who don't understand the issue. So I'm going full circle. I'm coming back to this. It must be digestible by societies. We cannot leave it to the nuclear physicists alone. We need to be able to understand it. It's of great importance that we understand it. Will we get that? I think we will, eventually. I think we will. It will sink in to politicians and power brokers that indeed we need to make that step or that step change in order to get there. I hope. That, you know.
Yes, I think. The coverage of the recent APEC conference in our newspapers gave one the impression that the leaders gathered there had already preempted the situation in Copenhagen, that there wasn't actually going to be the sort of legally binding outcome from that meeting that you've been describing. Now, was that a correct impression in your view or not?
I think it was. People were a bit taken by surprise. There was a pretty spiteful reaction on part of a number of about 40 environment ministers who met at the same time in Copenhagen. But, you know, environment ministers unfortunately sort of sit down at the table, you know, in many cabinets. So probably the message was correct. Since then, people have come back. The EU has come back strong. The others have come back. Obama is really considering seriously to come to Copenhagen. So that even if we do not get a legally binding instrument in 2 weeks in Copenhagen, little asterisk. In order to get that, we should have a draft on the table now. Just imagine. And there's no draft. There's a huge number of papers on it, but we have no agreement draft. So in order to negotiate that, we need an agreement draft. So I would say, to say we go for 1 year, is optimistic. It's optimistic. Will we get it in Mexico? Optimistic. And I'm talking about a legally binding instrument. I'm not talking about a political... That was a nice thing. I like that. Politically binding declaration or commitment in Copenhagen. That's beautiful. What does that mean? Politically binding? Nothing, you know. Spin in, I mean, golden.
It
it's your success, not a great success.
Exactly.
Thanks, Beth, for the address. Just thinking about the nationally appropriate mitigation actions, the NAMAs, that the US would need to bring it on board. Can you give some sense of what you think the US is looking for in that zone?
The problem that the US have everywhere is that the US Senate, when it comes to the ratification of international agreements, is very, very hesitant to accept an extranational judiciary. So the problem that we were grappling with under Kyoto 1 was the adoption of the compliance system. Now, if you want to have a legally binding system, you need the necessary compliance to go with it. And the U.S. is trying, in my opinion, knowing full well that that is their domestic situation, to go around that and have no international compliance system, but have a national compliance system, which would be a sort of no-regret target. Because if there is no punitive approach to it, it's much easier to make the Senate accept it. If there is an international punitive action, as it is under the compliance system now, where you would have to pay 1.3 times what you fell short under the first commitment period, that for the U.S. would be very hard to take. So they're trying to go around it with an applied MRV, measurable, reportable, verifiable system under the Ability Action Plan, in order to make it digestible in their own system. It's probably the best they can do. They can, however, join an international system if they see that they can sort of keep the handle on it in legal terms. So that's what they're talking
about. But isn't there a problem here, and a fundamental problem, that if the United States was to get its way, it actually undermines the Kyoto mechanisms. But if it doesn't get its way, then the United States is outside the framework again.
In a way, that's true. On the other hand, we never ratified the U.S. Exactly what that means.
So the Kyoto compliance mechanism isn't fully operational?
It's operational because it's politically binding. It has never been legally adopted. The Japanese had the same issue. So he was there. We have the compliance committee. It's sort of looking at things, but it could not be enforceable. Marines could not be sent in. No Chapter 7 under the UN for the compliance system. That's this. As long as there is a politically binding, more serious now, a politically binding acceptance of a compliance system acceptable to everyone, this might work. We should not forget that Kyoto was the first time that a punitive system was introduced. And a lot of countries sort of shrank back from it because it would have constituted a new step in giving up a little bit of your sovereignty. And a lot of countries were not ready to do that.
So when Canada says it wouldn't be breaching international law if it didn't meet its compliance obligations, it's technically potentially true, yes.
Some lawyer came up with that, probably. It's mean, but it's true.
Probably a final question.
Yes, please.
My concern is that your comment about the lumping of developing countries with the emerging economy could be detrimental to certain developing countries.
Yes, of course.
And also, looking at it from the other angle, you find the developed countries lumped together.
Yes.
Because the level of emission cannot be the same. So, how do you sympathize with the emerging countries, emerging economies, separating themselves from the developed countries, the developing countries, and also from the developed countries?
Well, it's basically easy. If you sympathize with the biosphere, you want to find the best solution for the biosphere. Now, if you want to find the best solution for the biosphere, you want to make sure that the ones that contribute in a detrimental way are the ones that contribute to the solution. Now, the ones that contribute in a detrimental way to the future of the biosphere are on both sides of the divide. And that's why I suggest, that's my personal opinion though, that everybody contributes to the level of their ability and to their contribution to the problem. I do not think that the Chinese interests or the American interests necessarily represent the Swiss interests. Neither do they represent the African interests.
I'm afraid we've got a class waiting to come in here, so we're going to have to wrap up. Could I just please thank Dr. Knobs for a stimulating address, and since it's maybe we'll ask address it. Victoria University, thank you for your contributions over the last 4 years here, and wish you well for your next appointment on behalf of the Swiss government. So can we show our appreciation?